Well, the hour of 8 being here, I'll call this meeting to order, and we do have a quorum. And I want to say, everybody, welcome back. Hopefully we can have a good session this year and get along well. And start out with, in your packet, there should be the agenda and there should be the rules that were sent out to everybody. And if you look through those, if they're pretty self-explanatory. As far as amendments, the rule that's there, and it's more so for the reasons so that our staff can get the packets loaded and we can get them amendments posted on the internet so that members of the public can see what the amendments are. We're asking that the rules be in by, or the amendments be in by 3 p.m. the day before the meeting. Now, I understand sometimes that's not always possible, and I've been flexible in the past, but hopefully we can do that and make it easier on our staff and easier on us to let the public know what's going on. So if you, those are the rules, and go forward from there. And we'll start the meeting with introductions, kind of tell who you are and where you're, a little bit about where you're from. And so I'll start out. I'm Michael Nelson. I'm state representative from 40A, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park, or as I joked at our DFL caucus before the session, that I am the representative for Brooklyn Park that was not running for speaker. And if we go to the right, we can go around the table.
Jim Geldman, committee administrator.
Matt Gehring from Nonpartisan House Research.
Good morning. Andrew Carlson from Bloomington.
My name is Brian Cook. I'm the Republican caucus researcher.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representative Tony Albright from Scott County.
Dwayne Qualm, Byron.
Bob Vogel from Elko Newmark and 20A, Southern Scott and Western Lee Sore County.
Steve Green, District 2B, Northwest Minnesota.
Jim Nash, Carver County, District 47A.
Deb Keel, District 1B, representing Polk, Red Lake, and most of Pennington County.
Mike Freiberg, District 45B, all are parts of Crystal, Golden Valley, New Hope, and Robbinsdale.
Todd Lippert, 20B, Montgomery, Lonsdale, Northfield.
Liz Olson, 7B, Central and West Parts of Duluth, and I'm not this short. The chair is just really low.
Jenny Cleborn, 44A, Plymouth.
John Hewitt, 57B, Apple Valley, Northern Apple Valley, Olive Rosemount, and Coates.
Good morning, Patty Akam, Northern Minnetonka, Southwestern Plymouth, and Woodland.
I'm Helen Roberts from the Nonpartisan House Fiscal Analysis Department.
I'm Sydney Spreck. I'm the committee legislative assistant.
And before we start, too, we normally ask people to silence their phones so they don't go off during the session. Also, we've had issues in the past where sometimes we get a lot of people using their phones, the recording upstairs that keeps what we say safe for posterity's sake it's hard to hear, that interferes with that. So that's why they ask people to silence their phones. Also, a note to the chairs, as I was coming down here today, walked past the supply room, and I heard that the chairs are being delivered today. So hopefully we can get our chairs replaced first, because these always seem to be the worst ones in the building. So we can always hold up. Anyway, with that, we have no minutes from the previous meeting, and first thing on our agenda is Minnesota Management and Budget is going to give us the presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome members to the committee, and state your name for the tape.
Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, and with me is Professor Laura Klumbakidis, the state economist. We're here to talk about the forecast and the economic situation. So what we'll do, if it's okay with Mr. Chair, we'll go through the PowerPoint and then take questions as we go along and keep things moving that way. Well, in fact, we'll start by sort of the high level of the forecast that was delivered in December. One of the things that we wanted to do was to, in this presentation, kind of go through the highlights of what we have talked about. Now, we've projected a $1.5 billion balance for 20 and 21, but we'll talk more about the challenges with that forecast and the interplay of inflation with that number. But there is a lot of good news in this budget in the sense that we do see economic expansion, but as Dr. Klumpkidis will describe, there's some weakening in the economic outlook. But the projected balance is going to grow in 20 and 21 because we're seeing an increase in revenues and a decreasing expenditures. The other good news that we want to talk about at the front here is the reserve. One of the big cornerstones of budget stability is an adequate reserve. And many of you who have been here for a number of years know that we've been working on this collectively, the legislature and the governor, over the last 8 years to rebuild the reserve, which is essentially zero back in 2011. So right now we know that the reserve has ticked up, and we now have a reserve balance over $2 billion. The actual amount is $2.075 billion. That's the statutory reserve account. And we also have a cash account of $350 million. So collectively, we almost have $2.5 billion in what we call the rainy day fund. So that provides us with the opportunity in the event of an economic downturn to have some flexibility in how we make decisions when we're faced with a drastic reduction in revenues, which occur in an economic downturn. The statutory reserve target right now is 5% of non-dedicated general funds, or $2.25 billion. We are now within $175 million of reaching that budget reserve target. The target is set each year and revised each year based upon the total amount of non-dedicated general fund revenues. So one of the things that we're really happy to talk about or have any questions about is where we go with this. But I'd like to now turn it over to Professor Klumpkidis to talk a little bit about the economic situation we face.
Thank you. And could you introduce yourself for the tape?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Laura Klumpkidis, the state economist. So I'm going to start by talking a bit about the outlook for the U.S. economy and how that changed between the last time we produced a forecast and February 2018 and November of 2018. Then I'll move to the Minnesota economy, and then I'll talk about changes to the revenue forecast. So the first chart that I have, the one titled U.S. Outlook Weakened Since February, compares current U.S. real GDP the current U.S. real GDP forecast by Minnesota's macroeconomic consulting firm IHS to their prior forecast. So the dark bars on this chart show the history and the November 2018 IHS forecast, the one that informed our November 2018 forecast. And the light bars show their February outlook. So if you focus at first on the years 2017 to 2023, so on the right-hand side of the chart, looking at that forecast comparison, you can see that the outlook for U.S. economic growth, especially after 2019, after this year, has weakened since Minnesota's forecast was prepared in February, so a year ago. Strong growth in the second and third quarters of 2018 led IHS to increase their expectations for this year's for last year's real GDP growth from 2.7% to 2.9% in November. They maintained their forecast for growth in 19 and 20, but their outlook for 21 to 23 is weaker than in February. And if you look at the November forecast, or just the November forecast for 18 to 23, just the dark bars on the right side of the chart, you can see a step down or a slowdown in economic growth through our forecast horizon. So current conditions can support moderate growth in 2019 and 2020. In 2019. IHS expects the economy to begin slowing late this year. So this occurs as the fiscal stimulus from the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the contribution to economic growth or the acceleration in growth from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act begins to be reduced. So the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act had an accelerating effect that raised the levels of real GDP, but that boost slows down. Monetary policy becomes more restrictive, global growth weakens, and a strong U.S. dollar relative to our trading partners' currencies pulls down net exports. And then after mid-2020, they also include in their outlook a decline in the labor force participation rate for the United States that's demographically driven, so driven by the aging of the population. And that's expected to slow the economy even more. And then the downshift continues with annual real GDP growth expected to decelerate from 2.9%, so sort of the high point there, annually last year to less than half that rate in 2023. And then we released our, just as an aside, we released our quarterly report on January 10th, and we showed that the U.S. outlook by IHS is lower now than it was when we produced our November forecast. And so they now have, they've taken between 1/10 and 2/10 of a percent of growth out of each year in the forecast horizon. So the forecast for 2019 for this year is now 2.5%, and for next year it's 2.0, and then it goes to 1.5 in 21 and 22. The history on the chart, so the dark bars to the left, the years since the recession of 08 and 09, illustrates one of the risks to this forecast. The dotted line shows the average annual real GDP growth during the 20 years prior to the Great Recession, and that was 3.1%. So we used to be able to expect annual real GDP growth in the threes, but that now is much higher than what is in our current forecast. And when the economy is growing slowly, there's not much margin for error. It's harder to recover from a setback than when growth is higher. And as you all know, the U.S. expansion is now the second longest on record. It is, in this forecast, it is forecast to break that record because we have a forecast for growth that continues through our horizon. And a mature low-growth expansion is particularly vulnerable when negative shocks occur. The next chart compares Minnesota's labor market performance to the nation's. This chart shows the headline unemployment rate, so the unemployment rate that's usually reported in the newspaper. The dark line is for Minnesota. The light line is for the United States. The vertical gray bars are the U.S. recessions, so the white space between those gray bars are the recovery and then expansion periods between the recessions. The U.S. expansion is in its 10th year, which is, as I said, a long expansion, but Minnesota's steady economic performance and tight labor market continue. Even as available workers are becoming scarce, the state's steady job growth has kept the unemployment rate low. Minnesota's unemployment rate currently stands between the low points of the prior two expansions at 2.8%, nearly one percentage point below the U.S., half a percentage point below last year, the fifth lowest among states and the lowest we've seen in 18 years. The next chart also illustrates, is another illustration of Minnesota's tight labor market. And when I say a tight labor market, I mean low unemployment at the same time that we have high demand for labor. The gray bars, the height of the gray bars, shows the total number of unemployed workers statewide. The dark bars show the total number of job vacancies statewide again. In the height of the gray bars, you can see the peak of unemployment during the recession, and you can see how Minnesota's steady employment growth throughout the recession has just drawn that down and drawn people into employment. You can also see in the from the recession, the dark bars, so the demand for labor, open positions, has fairly steadily risen. And the dark bars then, if you look all the way to the most recent data, show that the job vacancies statewide have grown to a very high level. The ratio of unemployed persons to job vacancies statewide has been less than one over the past year. And I was saying it was a tight labor market then, but it is now down to about 0.7. That means there are fewer unemployed job seekers than open positions across the state. And a tight labor market, that tight labor market is being felt across the state of Minnesota. For the first time in this data series, it's not a very long data series, but the first time since these job vacancy data have been collected, both the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota have fewer unemployed persons than job vacancies. The large number of open positions illustrates a strong demand for Minnesota workers and certainly not an unwillingness of Minnesotans to work. In fact, the data show Minnesotans to be very hardworking. The overall labor force participation rate, the share of the population that's 16 and over, that's either working or actively looking for work, is well above the national level and is the highest among U.S. states. And the flip side of that low unemployment rate that I showed you in the previous chart is a very high share of the over 16 population that's working, that employment to population ratio. That's also well above the U.S. and the highest among U.S. states.
Moving to the revenue forecast. Total general, this is from our November forecast that we released in early December. Total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $609 million more than the February forecast. So in this chart, in the first two columns are the current forecast and the forecast change for the current biennium. And then the next two columns are the current forecast and the forecast change for the next biennium. So looking at the current biennium, that's $609 million. Higher expected individual income, corporate, and other tax revenue more than offsets a reduced forecast for sales tax revenue. In addition to the changes in the near-term economic outlook, this forecast reflects new estimates of the revenue impacts from the taxpayer responses to the federal tax law changes in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as well as additional sales tax revenue expected to arise from a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling regarding the state taxation of remote sales. The largest dollar amount change in the current biennium revenue forecast is in the individual income tax, which is forecast to generate $419 million more in the current biennium than we had estimated last February, due to higher than expected income tax revenues at the close of fiscal year 18 and slightly higher forecast income growth the last calendar year. These positive changes offset a revenue forecast reduction due to expected taxpayer responses to the federal tax law change, such as individuals choosing to itemize deductions on their Minnesota returns, even though they take the standard deduction for federal tax purposes. Sales tax revenue in the current biennium is now forecast to be $120 million less than the February forecast. This change is due to lower than expected gross sales tax receipts so far in the current biennium, slightly slower projected growth in spending on taxable goods and services, and higher forecast sales tax refunds in fiscal year 19. We also added to sales tax revenue, to the sales tax revenue forecast, for the impact of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in South Dakota versus Wayfair, which allows states to require remote sellers to collect and remit sales or use tax on sales to customers within the state. That revenue addition, which we did make, was not large enough to offset the negative changes I already mentioned. And then the forecast change for the next biennium shows a similar pattern, but at lower levels of magnitude. Higher forecast individual income, corporate, and other tax revenues offset a slightly lower sales tax forecast to raise the revenue forecast for FY 20 and 21 by $190 million. And the dynamics are similar in this biennium, too. Faster growing individual income, especially non-wage income, offsets a revenue reduction from taxpayer decisions, those taxpayer decisions as a consequence of the TCJA, and an additional addition to forecast sales tax revenue for that Wayfair decision is not quite large enough to completely offset a lower base of sales tax receipts and a higher refund forecast. So if you'll recall the deceleration of growth that I showed in that first real GDP chart, that step down in growth over our planning horizon, note that growth in total revenues for the state of Minnesota is also declining over the three biennia included in our November forecast. Revenues are still growing across these years. So as long as the height of the bars here, so the height of the bars show the annualized total revenue growth for each biennium. So it's the growth per year, but within that biennium. And as long as those bars are above the horizon, that means that revenues are growing. But the pace of growth is slowing. On the chart, we illustrate that between the last biennium and the current one, total revenues grow 3.4%, or are forecasted to grow 3.4% per year. Annualized. The rate falls to 3.2% between the current biennium and the next, and then falls again to 2.5% between 20 and 21 and 22 and 23. Budget Director Ray Tun will talk about the impact of that revenue growth slowdown in the state's structural balance. So let me conclude by drawing your attention to some of the risks to the forecast. This forecast assumes that all of the U.S. tariffs and other countries' retaliatory measures that were in place or scheduled in early November are in place. So that included everything that was both in place and scheduled. So that means that the step up in U.S. tariffs to 25% on Chinese goods was assumed in the November forecast. But as we noted in our January update, IHS has removed that assumption in their current U.S. economic outlook because we have a there's been a 90-day postponement of those tariffs. But as you know, U.S. trade policy, so especially regarding China and the new NAFTA agreement, has been in flux. And that's assumed in this outlook, but prolonged uncertainty, so if this uncertainty goes on longer than expected, or if it accelerates, that imposes costs on businesses that have to address supply chain disruptions, and they may put investment plans on hold. And when businesses slow investment, that slows GDP growth, because business investment is a contributor to GDP growth. The stock market's solid gains of early 2018 were wiped away by volatility at the end of 2018. In this forecast, IHS expects the stock market to remain volatile, but with continued low appreciation in equity values. So if the stock market decline that we were looking at the end of last year, if that worsens, or if the market generally underperforms IHS's expectations, the resulting erosion of household wealth could cause consumer spending to grow more slowly than forecast. So the way the stock market generally plays into the GDP forecast is through household portfolios. When people's portfolios have lower value, they feel less wealthy, and they spend less. And consumer spending is the largest contributor to GDP growth. Oops, let me go back. As I said, the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, that made some big changes to federal tax law. Now, Minnesota's tax law didn't change, but those big changes to federal tax law caused individuals and business owners to face some decisions about how to respond to the law. But we haven't yet seen tax returns from 2017 or 2018, so uncertainty remains for us about how people and corporations actually did respond to the changes and how those choices affect state tax revenues. And we've made assumptions or estimates of how those changes affect tax revenues, but we don't know yet how that plays out. And then finally, with 30 months at the time of the time we produced the forecast, before the end of 20 and 21, we haven't yet seen any of the total revenues we forecast for the biennium. We hadn't at the time of the forecast. Even small changes to assumed growth rates and particularly volatile income sources, such as capital gains or corporate profits, could materially alter the budget picture into our planning horizon. I'm happy to take questions. If there aren't questions, I can pass it on to Budget Director Raton.
Representative Albright, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, series of questions for you, and I'm going to go back to the first one where we rely upon IHS for our modeling for economic growth or thereof. I'm just wondering, much like weather, you know, you see the European model, and you see these other models that weather forecasters use. Mm-hmm. Is there a strong symmetry between not only the IHS model, but other models that you might look at and compare notes with? Mm-hmm. Is there, you know, a strong congruency between what IHS is suggesting to the state, mm-hmm. and others?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Albright. So we write up for each forecast, as you know, we have our Council of Economic Advisors review the U.S. macro outlook, and they produce a statement that's in our book about how does this forecast compare, how do they evaluate this forecast, how much risk is there in it. So how much risk is Minnesota assuming by using this forecast? And one of the things that we write about in there is how IHS compares to the other macroeconomic forecasters in the Blue Chip consensus. So the Blue Chip is a survey of 50 macroeconomic forecasters. And I don't at the moment remember precisely where IHS was, but it was very close to the Blue Chip consensus at the time, and it remains close to the Blue Chip consensus. And I've noted when I was looking at those data the other day that IHS has been one of the IHS and macroeconomic advisors, they're merged now. Mm. So those firms together have won a couple of the Blue Chips awards for the most accurate forecast. So yes, this is a roughly a consensus forecast.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's notable, I think, in terms of our unemployment rate with regard to the federal rate, but I'm just wondering, if you were to draw any conclusions based upon the two most recent economic expansions with regard to the labor participation rate, mm-hmm. can you draw any conclusions with regard to similarities or differences between the labor participation rate in this economic expansion and the labor participation rate in the most previous two economic expansions. Are there differences that would tip us off to, are we following the same pattern, or is this one somewhat different from the previous two?
Professor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, interesting question. So, let's see, where's the better picture of the expansions? So the state's labor force participation rate, as I said, is very high relative to other states, and it's very high relative to the United States participation rate. But it is low relative to our own history. So the labor force participation rate for the U.S. and for Minnesota has gone down. And so in the previous two expansions, the labor force participation rate would have been higher than it is now. So we have a lower ratio of people over age 16 who are in the labor force, either looking for work or working. There are a lot of reasons for that, for the reduction in the decline in the labor force participation rate over time at the U.S., at the U.S. level. For Minnesota, the recent level of the labor force participation rate is driven by aging of the population. And so the biggest difference, I think, is that the population is older, and that in this expansion, the baby boom, which is a really large group of people moving into an age class that has a very low labor force participation rate, that is pulling the labor force participation rate down. That's particularly true for Minnesota because we don't have a large number of people on the bench, so people who have dropped out of the labor force, discouraged workers. There are some states that do still have that slack in the labor market, but Minnesota doesn't. So how does that affect this this expansion? Well, in a state like Minnesota, we don't have a lot of room to draw more people into the labor force as demand for labor expands. And so that's why there may be some, and so hopefully we're getting more people in. But because the population is aged and we don't have a lot of people who have dropped out, then there's not a lot of room. That doesn't leave us a lot of room to grow, so it leaves us in this tight situation.
Doctor, just to follow on to that one then, you also mentioned about job vacancies, and I'm wondering if with the aging demographic that you just spoke of, if there's any correlation to the industry sectors that are seeing the most vacancies within the state's economy.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Can you go professors.
Ahead? Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, so the industries that have the largest job vacancies is the question. So it is usually the case with job vacancies that the industries that show the largest numbers of vacancies are the ones that have a lot of turnover generally. So we generally see high job vacancies in leisure and hospitality, so these service industries, and they do have high job vacancies at the time. I'm just trying to see if I have any specific notes on it. So that much is true, but vacancies at this point for the state of Minnesota, because we've had this tight labor market for a while and it's across the state, vacancies are widespread right now among occupations. So the largest numbers of openings are in healthcare, accommodation, food services, and retail trade. So those are healthcare has a wide range of types of jobs, but all of those are fairly high turnover areas, but we also have high vacancies right now in manufacturing and in construction, and so it's widespread. So you asked, I think, does this have any connection to the aging of the population? One connection is that as the population ages, we have very high demand for healthcare services, and so the healthcare sector is facing this tight labor market just like all the other sectors, but they seem to have a stronger demand pressure, so demand for labor pressure. And so that sector is facing challenges with this.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And finally, Doctor, for the benefit of the wonks in the room, I noted in the November-December number that revenues on the individual taxes were down about $102 million from forecast. I'm wondering if that's a precursor a blip on the radar, or if there's any observation that you might offer the committee in terms of why that came in so precipitously low in regard to the forecast when all the other categories seem to be doing as expected.
Okay. Professor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Albright, you're referring to the most recent quarterly report where we report what's happened since the forecast. Yes, indeed, the individual income tax actual receipts for the months of November and December that we reported last week are on net $169 million lower than our November forecast. The bulk of that was in estimated tax payments. So these are prepayments that taxpayers make on current year liability. And those were $128 million below the forecast. So generally, we let people know that you have to look at both December and January estimated tax payments together, the receipts that come in for estimated tax payments together, because in order to see what the final quarter of estimated payments really tells us. Because in the past, taxpayers have had an incentive. Their estimated tax payment for the fourth quarter is due in January, but they've had an incentive to accelerate that payment into the end of the prior calendar year so that they can deduct those payments from their federal taxes for that year. And so we see a push of receipts that are due in January. We see them pushed into December. And so we like to look at December and January together to see how that fourth quarter really looks. But with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and the reduction in the benefit of state and local tax deductions, that there isn't that much of an incentive anymore. So we assumed that there was still some incentive that some taxpayers still would accelerate that payment because they simply always do it and they just sort of kept doing it. Or there are taxpayers that are subject to the federal net investment income tax, and for that they do get to deduct the state taxes that they pay on investment income. So we thought there are some high income taxpayers that still have an incentive to accelerate, so we assumed that there was some acceleration still to occur. We now know that there was less acceleration than we had forecast, and so fewer taxpayers paid their January payment in December. What we don't know is what that January payment is. So we still need to see that January payment together with the December payment to say what happened in the fourth quarter. It could be that our over forecast of acceleration explains the whole thing. Or it could be that fourth quarter payments indeed are lower than what we had estimated them to be. And that could be because non-wage income, capital gains income in particular, may have been lower than we forecast. So that's the explanation with all the information that we have now. We still don't know the answer, but we will know. We'll have more information with the next revenue report.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hertaus, and if you can introduce yourself before you ask your question.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I'm Representative Jerry Hertaus. I represent House District 33A, which is the western part of Hennepin County, basically from St. Bonifacius all the way up to the city limits of northern part of Greenfield, Hanover city line, about 35-40% of the geographic area of Hennepin County. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question revolves around the aging demographic of baby boomers, of which many of us in this room are a member of. As we all know, and I've read quite a bit of information about this data set, from K-12 through colleges through housing, now we're looking at medical care. We also see that our population is generally healthier in terms of lifespan and living longer. And I'm wondering if you have what information you have that has taken into consideration this group. As a home builder, I found that we weren't really experiencing the so-called downsizing by baby boomers. We found a great part of our business were actually empty nesters and people in their late 50s, a part of that baby boom group were actually building bigger homes. And so it was a little bit antithetical to a lot of what we hear about in terms of the the aging population. The other thing that I've read is that this population, which seems to contradict what I just said, is also very ill-prepared for retirement. The average couple, according to IRS data, has a net worth of $130,000, of which 60% of that net worth is the equity in their home. So it causes me to think that with longevity and generally a healthier population, that they're going to remain in the workforce, unlike our grandparents, who basically shut it off at 62, 63, 65. And so I'm curious about what data you've used, if any, in shaping your projections as we go forward, because it's been reported that 10,000 baby boomers are retiring each and every day in this country, and certainly Minnesota has a share of that. And I've been most interested in wanting to help reform some of the things in Minnesota to maintain this population in the state, because if they are so ill-prepared for retirement, I'm seeing increasingly, especially in my district, people leaving the state to lower tax or no tax states to get to wring more out of their retirement benefits and or whatever. That doesn't mean they're going to quit working, but I think they're looking at more favorable places to live. And so I'm concerned about maintaining their presence in the state, their economic impact in terms of consumption, and keeping them near their family. So maybe you could give some reflection, if anything, how that plays into your forecast.
Professor?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Hurtas, the population forecast that we use when we do our Minnesota economic forecast is from the state demographer's office. And so we're consistent with what her office is saying. And in terms of the baby boom population, this is a great question. It's a common question that we have a tight labor force, and so can we expect baby boomers to work longer, and is that going to help ease this? The state demographer has assumed in her forecast that the current generation of 65-year-olds or 62-year-olds is going to work longer than the previous generations, and so that assumption is in there. I don't remember exactly what the labor force participation rate is that she's assuming, but she is assuming that they work longer than previous generations. And so that's already in here. And what I recall from previous work that the state demographer's office has done is that she did some simulations to see, well, what if we made some pretty heroic assumptions about how long baby boomers are going to work? Even if you make some pretty dramatic assumptions about their labor force participation rate, because the group is so large, you can't grow your way out of this labor force tightness. So this is something that's going to stay, and it may be alleviated as people make their decisions going forward, and those decisions are informed, of course, by things like how much money they have and what the value of their homes are and things like that. But even heroic assumptions don't allow us to grow out of this situation.
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a few questions. A lot of them are additional bits of information that maybe could be passed on to the committee to help us have a better understanding as we look at bills and the budget as they evolve. But frankly, sort of a downer on the forward projection. I would have thought that there'd be more optimistic outlook with the new legislature coming in, but apparently, not a lot of optimism at what the wonderful things we might be able to do. How much of the contribution to the projected growth is for Minnesota and the nation is from the workforce shortage? Is it a mild contributor, or it's a major break, because it's hard to expand if you can't grow the workforce?
Professor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative,
I can't put a number. I can't specifically on how the tight, specifically how the tight labor market feeds in to, you know, to give you a quantitative answer there for Minnesota. For the U.S., as I said, IHS has, so if you look at, oops, other way, look at that GDP chart, they have in 2020, so from 19 to 2020, there are a lot of things going on that cause that slowdown. One of them is slower global growth. One of them is the stronger U.S. dollar. But one of the things that happens in 2020 is they anticipate a reduction in the U.S. labor force participation rate. So that's a labor force-driven effect, and that contributes to the lower growth going forward. But I do not have a I can't give you a number for that.
Mr. Chair, that brings up the first request for data. You've got a nice chart with unemployment. It'd be nice to be able to see the state and national labor participation rate graphed on that, because I was curious about the blip in 16 to 17 where it went up, if that was a if there was a corresponding more people were getting back into labor, those type of things are sort of help us, because frankly, Department of Ed and other parts of our state can have an impact at the capabilities and matching between skill and opening, and the global picture is nice to understand. Are there any legislative actions required for your adjustment because of the Wayfair decision? You adjusted the sales tax revenue, and I'm wondering if we have to, you're anticipating that the state will do something to help facilitate that.
Professor.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, no, there isn't any legislative action required for that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had touched on the topic of aging, even a little bit on the outflow. Is it possible to get a, for the committee, 20 years of demographics of, the population? Because we all hear about neighbors and people moving south when the kids get older so that they don't worry about slipping on the ice or et cetera. Maybe they just, like beaches with sun and not snow. But it might help us understand some of the demographics there, because you had touched that part of the issue with the workforce participation is aging. And if a fair portion of our senior citizens are moving south for whatever reason, that would affect the total demographic pool we've got, so that the workforce participation should actually be getting better, because we'd have that adjustment. And then in line with that, it'd be nice to have over the last 20 years a chart of the population versus income, because oftentimes senior citizens have, investment income. I'd like to understand, how the state as a whole, if in this growth of job and employment, if the average, the big bubble is moving up on the income, that helps us understand sort of the demographics of what the, if we do any shifts, in funding different programs, but also what the revenue, the big picture. It's nice to have a little bit more background data on that. Other than that, are there any possible, and this would actually be a responsive question as opposed to a request for data, any additional assumptions that are being made in regards to tax conformity and other aspects that could have a shift in what the projections are made, such as we did with the prepay shift in the federal?
Professor.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, so regarding the demographic data, your best source for that is the State Demographer's Office, and so I'm sure you can get good long-term economic data there from her. One quick point I failed to mention with regard to the labor market is one of the bright points or possible bright points for the tight labor market in Minnesota is that after 15 years of data showing that Minnesota on net annually would lose people to other states on net, so that looking at the net people coming into Minnesota from other states, people leaving Minnesota to other states, that was negative for 15 years prior to 2017. Our total net immigration was positive because our international immigration was positive, and that more than made up the difference. But starting in 17 and also repeated in 18, that net domestic immigration is positive, and so Minnesota is now has for those two years gained people from other states, and that's a positive factor for our labor force. On the conformity question, so the way we construct a forecast, we construct a current law forecast, and we don't try to anticipate what the legislature is going to do and what changes are going to happen, and so there is no assumption of conformity in this forecast. And so when that happens, when or if tax laws change, then we estimate the revenue impact. And when we estimate that revenue impact, you're right that we're also trying to figure out how behavior might change that might affect not only how much money we are likely to get or likely not to get, but when that money is likely to come in. So you're right that the decisions that taxpayers make affects that timing, and that can muddy our outlook. So when those legislative changes are made, that will affect the forecast.
Representative Kwan.
Mr. Chair, if the demographic data is better sourced from somewhere else, maybe staff could try and get that. I just would like the committee to understand, because there are a lot of things going on that are interactive, and this is not a trivial topic. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, we have more of this presentation, so we can make our questions short and get our answers short, because I know the commissioner has to be someplace at 9:30, and we also have another presentation for us, so we can move it along a little bit. Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are brief. I'm just curious to the testifiers. On your chart regarding job vacancies, have you tracked what sectors those jobs are in? And then have you tracked the geographic distributions of where those openings are? Are they metro, outstate? If you could help us out with that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Professor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, representative. So DEED produces these data, and so you can get detailed data from them. The job vacancies, if you look at it statewide, the job vacancies are widespread, as I said. So they're in those high turnover occupations like healthcare, accommodation, and food services, but they're also in almost every industry, and manufacturing and construction are both industries that have a high level of job vacancy relative to what they usually have. The ratio of unemployed workers to job vacancies is below one, so fewer job seekers, unemployed job seekers than vacancies, both in the metro and outstate. Let me see if I have the vacancy rate for I was looking for the metro versus non-metro. Okay. The Twin Cities job vacancy rate, which is the number of vacancies per 100 jobs, was 5.7% in the Twin Cities and 4.8% in greater Minnesota. And then DEED also reports what I said, which is that for the first time on record, both the Twin Cities and greater Minnesota have a ratio of less than one unemployed person to every job vacancy.
Representative Nash. Okay. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, I believe you already answered this, but just to confirm, you made the statement that Minnesota currently is experiencing a net gain in migration. Okay. And then as a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair, Professor, do you see that trend continuing?
Professor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, representative. So to be clear, we have for a long time have net gain in, have had net gain in immigration in total because international immigration made up for a net loss in domestic. And so the change has been we now have a positive in net domestic. Do I see that trend continuing? I certainly was, I wasn't ready to say it's a trend when it was just 1 year of data. Can I declare a trend at 2 years of data? Well, I'll tell you, it wouldn't surprise me if it continued because we have a tight labor market and because that's that in our forecast, that we're assuming that that's causing wages per worker to grow. It makes sense. If the supply is tight, then wages should go up. Even though, for instance, housing costs have increased in the Twin Cities, they're still lower than in the big coastal cities. And so I think Minnesota is looking like an attractive place for people to live. And so if we want to help give some momentum to that trend, then what we want to do is invest in things in things that make the Minnesota a place where people who are looking for a place to live, whether they're in another state or in another country, making Minnesota an attractive place to live.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate that.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got a quick question. You make reference to the fact that population actually is growing because of the migration in, but yet there's a drop in the labor participation. Do you have any estimations as to why that is?
Mm-hmm. Professor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is because of the changing age profile of the state. So we have, as I said, the baby boom population is just the elephant in every room when you talk about labor force. And so it is so large, and it's, you know, so the way you look at these demographics is you look at what the labor force participation rate is for people in different age groups. And the labor force participation rate for people over 65 is just plain low, even if, you know, some of us are plan to work longer. And having such a large group of people move into an age group that has that low participation rate, that's going to bring the participation rate down for the state.
So I'm just going to do one more, and that's all. And then we've got to move because it doesn't really make sense. Because if we're getting people in, then we have people that we should be able to fill these positions with, regardless of the age of the people that are retiring. So there's a population growth, but a lower participation rate in labor. So just the idea that there's it's because people who are retiring are older. I mean that's just a fact. But there should be a younger group coming in than to replace them, and so why the lower participation rate? And that's my last question.
Well, Representative Green, I know from my experience this last summer as a retired carpenter, I got called back and asked to work because there's the shortage of skills gap of people that are out there that some of them can't get into those jobs. And I know in construction there's a huge gap, and there's still a huge gap in the number of people working in the jobs that are out there. We're constantly having not being able to fill jobs. So, Professor.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is simply the case that there aren't enough people, that it's not the same number of people coming in as the number of people who are retiring. But over time, maybe that will change. But as I said, that baby boom population is just too large to expect the participation rate to go up much more, even as younger people come into the state of Minnesota. And to be clear, our labor force participation rate, as I said, is low relative to our history, but it is the highest among states. And so we really do have high participation by the people who are of working age.
With that, continue with your presentation, Commissioner France, and if you would introduce yourself for the tape.
I'm Britta Raton, State Budget Director, and I'm going to take us back to slide 4 in the presentation, and this gives us a look at the budgetary balance in the current biennium, and I'm just going to walk us through how we build up to that $1.5 billion budgetary balance in 20 and 21. So on slide 4, so what this slide is showing you is a comparison of the fiscal year 18 and 19 biennium from our end of session estimates to our current November forecast. And as you can see in the lower right corner, the overall budgetary balance has increased by $432 million since our estimates as of end of session. And this is after the allocation of additional funding to our budget reserve. So since the end of session, revenue estimates have increased by $609 million, and Dr. Kolumbakidis just walked through the drivers of those changes. And expenditure estimates have declined by $306 million, and I'll walk through a little more detail on that in a few slides. But also, even before the statutory allocation of 33% of the balance to the reserve balance increased by $137 million due to two additional statutory allocations in law. The first of which is a $90 million increase due to remaining funds in the health care premium subsidy program, and those were canceled back to the reserve. If you recall, the health care premium subsidy program was funded out of the reserve with language that remaining funds would be returned to the reserve at the end of fiscal year 18. The second is a $47 million of excess surplus from the workers' comp assigned risk plan. There's statutory language that allocates the excess surplus from that plan to the reserve, and so $47 million was deposited into the reserve. So those two combined put $137 million into the reserve even before this forecast calculation. Moving to the next line, the stadium reserve declined by $8 million relative to our previous forecast, and this reduction is due to a decision that, given the size of the stadium reserve, it's no longer necessary to continue to deposit $20 million in corporate franchise tax revenue into the reserve. That corporate franchise tax revenue, $20 million a year, was a supplemental resource to the reserve that was added, and there was language in law that allowed that to be turned off when the reserve no longer needed it. And so that decision was made with this forecast. Mm-hmm. So these changes leave us with an estimated balance of $1.074 billion. 33% of that, which is $354 million, is allocated to the reserve. And that $354 million plus the $137 million that I talked about previously as deposited into the reserve brings the total reserve change to $491 million. And that's the number that Commissioner Franz referenced earlier when talking about the reserve. So this leaves $720 million available to balance forward into the next biennium. So you'll see that $720 million on the budgetary balance line for fiscal years 18 and 19. So that brings us to the next slide.
And Mr. Tan, I just want to point out, the stadium reserve, is that a separate account, or is that basically numbers that are generated and part of the general fund? Because we keep hearing a lot about that. And people eyeing that to spend, but is that a separate silo of money that's sitting there, or is that just part of the overall general fund?
Mr. Chair, it is tracked as a separate line, but it is contained within the general fund. So we show it on our general fund statements, but it is tracked as a segregated pot of money within the general fund.
Proceed.
So moving to the next slide. This next slide provides the budgetary picture for fiscal years 20 and 21, and this is where you can see the $1.544 billion that's projected to be available in the next biennium. A combination of increased revenues and decreased expenditures, as well as that increase in the balance that's rolling forward from the current biennium, is what drives the increase in the estimated balance in this coming biennium when compared to end of session. Again, revenues have increased in this biennium by $190 million, and expenditures are projected to decline by $489 million when compared to our previous estimates. And on this chart, you can once again see the $491 million increase in the reserve balance. So we continue to track that change in the reserve. And again, the stadium reserve balance is reduced by $22 million from previous estimates. I want to make clear it's still growing year over year, but this is a decrease from previous estimates. And again, this is due to the removal of the corporate franchise tax as a supplemental resource into the reserve. And then I'll provide further drivers of the expenditure detail on the next slide I'm going to, so we'll skip past Dr. Kolumbakidis' slides. So jumping to slide 12. So this is the slide that details the change in expenditures, and it's similar to the chart that Dr. Kolumbakidis walked you through previously about the revenue changes. Compares our forecast in November to our previous forecast, but it just provides the numbers for the November forecast and then gives you the forecast change. I'll walk through each line. E12 expenditures are virtually unchanged from our previous forecast. The change since end of session in both biennia is less than 0.1%, so very little change there. Property tax aids and credits have increased relative to end of session estimates by $11 million in fiscal years 18 and 19 and $64 million in fiscal years 20 and 21. And this is largely due to growth in property tax refunds for homeowners. I'm going to just skip past Health and Human Services for a moment, which is the largest driver of change, and that's because the next slide provides a bit more detail. Moving to debt service, estimated spending on debt service is down by $26 million in fiscal years 2018 and 19 due to a smaller bond sale than originally anticipated and the fact that we received lower rates on those bonds. In 20 and 21, the estimated expenditures are increasing by $18 million, and it's really for the inverse reasons. We expect a larger bond sale next summer. It was just a delay of some bonds being sold from this summer into next summer. And we also are assuming an increase in the rates that we will receive on those bonds. The all other category changes by $74 million in fiscal years 18 and 19. And the largest driver of that change is a $90 million in lower spending on the healthcare premium subsidy program. And that's that $90 million I mentioned earlier, which was deposited into the reserve. In 20 and 21, the all other line declines by $40 million. $26 million of that reduction is in the area of corrections, and it's due to a lower prison population forecast than we previously anticipated. So moving back up to the Health and Human Services line, expenditure estimates are down $216 million in fiscal years 18 and 19 relative to end of session. This is due to lower enrollment across program areas, as well as additional federal revenue for chemical dependency treatment. In fiscal years 20 and 21, total estimated expenditures declined by $517 million. And approximately $383 million of that, or 75% of the change, is in the area of medical assistance. So going to the next slide, it'll just provide a visual of the change in medical assistance. So this chart shows the total change in medical assistance in this forecast through the next biennium. The top line is the end of session estimate, and the bottom line is the estimate in this past November's forecast. The largest component of change within medical assistance is lower than expected growth in managed care rates. The blue portion, the grayish portion of the space between the lines represents the savings due to those managed care rates. Rates for calendar year 2019 grew less than anticipated, and those rates were based on the actual experience of the most recent closed calendar year, which was 2017, and those rates were lower than expected. And this impact of lower rates in our managed care plans carries through and reduces the cost over the forecast period. And the reduced growth in those rates is likely due to the health plan's efforts to lower their costs following the competitive bidding that was done for calendar year 2016. There are other changes within medical assistance, which is represented by that dotted section above the blue on the chart. And the biggest drivers of those changes include the lower enrollment in medical assistance, as well as additional federal funding for chemical dependency treatment. Moving to the next slide, this returns us to a view of total revenue and expenditures in the general fund. And this slide gives the first look at the planning estimates for fiscal years 22 and 2023. This chart shows the structural balance between revenues and expenditures in fiscal years 20 and 21 and 22 and 23, which means it's removing from the chart the impact of the balance forwards and the contributions to the reserves. So you can see in this chart that the structural balance declines into the planning years. Revenues are only exceeding expenditures in 22-23 by $456 million. I also want to highlight that this is representing the structural balance in the general fund. Not included in this total is the projected deficit in the healthcare access fund. With the expiration of the provider tax, the healthcare access fund is forecast to have a $969 million deficit in 22 and 23. The healthcare access fund pays for a number of state programs, including about 6% of our medical assistance program, the rest of which for the medical assistance program is funded by the general fund. In this forecast, those expenditures that have historically been in the healthcare access fund remain tracked in the healthcare access fund, which is what causes that deficit. In the coming legislative sessions, policymakers will need to determine whether to lower spending in that fund or to increase revenues in the healthcare access fund in order to address that shortfall. So moving back to the view of the general fund, projected spending in the general fund grows from fiscal years 20 and 21 to 22 and 23 at 2.9% annualized. This is greater than the growth of 2.5% annually that Dr. Kolumbakidis talked about, which is the growth in revenue into our tails years. The biennial growth shown in expenditures is growth that's just occurring within our forecast programs, and the biggest driver of that growth is growth within medical assistance. I also just want to highlight that inflation is generally not included in our forecast estimates. It's only included for about 20% of our spending in the general fund, and it's on those programs that have a inflationary factor built into the formula or programs that are funded based on actual costs. So some examples of places where inflation is accounted for in our cost estimates would be property tax refunds, special education has an inflationary factor in the forecast, and a portion of health care that's based on costs and actual negotiated rates would have inflation built in. So the estimate of inflation included on the slide is only applied to those expenditures that don't already include an inflationary factor. And this gives a sense of the cost pressures that exist in the upcoming biennium as well as in the planning years. And you'll notice the number grows significantly into 22 and 23, and that's because the impact of inflation is compounded from the 2021 biennium into 22 and 23. Now I can pass it back to Commissioner Franz.
Representative Albright, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Reitan, you mentioned that in the recent issuance of bonds, that we actually realized a lower rating on those bonds, or maybe I heard you wrong, because that was contrary to the increase in the rating itself. So if you could just make sure I heard what you said right.
Mr. Tan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I'm sorry if I misspoke what I was trying to say. We received a lower rate, the rate we pay, interest rate, okay, that we paid on the bonds, because
Not rating,
a lower interest rate on the bonds, Thank you. Which is potentially due to an improved rating.
You also, thank you, Mr. Chair, you also mentioned, and I just want to make sure that in the fiscal 22-23, the Health Care Access Fund will have a deficit of how much did you say?
Mr. Tan.
Mr. Chair and
million?
Representative Albright, I want to just flip back to my notes to make sure I get it right. It is $969 million, and this is with the expiration of the provider tax. There's no the largest source of revenue into that fund is ending, so that's why that deficit is there.
And just a final question then. You've made some adjustments to the Stadium Reserve Fund. I'm just wondering if you or the commissioner would be willing to prognosticate on what, because you mentioned that revenues from that are still growing, what would be an appropriate fund balance to maintain going forward?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question. I think one of the things that back in 2012 when the Vikings legislation for the stadium was passed, obviously we dedicated new revenues from charitable gambling with the addition of electronic poll tabs to fund the payment of the debt from the stadium. So that decision to select and dedicate specific revenues for that payment, we also assumed that if those revenues came in excess, we'd put those in a reserve account, which we now have the stadium reserve, and they'd be used to backfill any shortfall that might occur in an annual on an annual payments. So several times in the last over the last 8 years or so, we've had a couple shortfalls where we have actually used some of the stadium reserve fund to make the annual all the annual payments. So the question really becomes, you know, what is the appropriate level? We did not estimate that at the time of the Vikings legislation. There was no decision, but it should reach a certain level. So there's no specific number in the legislation itself. We've always taken the position that we should have at least 1 year's worth of debt service in the fund at a minimum to make sure that we can meet the needs of the debt payments. So right now, as of June 30, 2018, for the first time, we had over $40 million in actual funds, not an estimate, but actual funds in that reserve account. And at that point, that's when we said, well, this is at least the minimum amount that we want in there in terms of actual receipts and not a projection. So that fed into our decision in December. But the other thing, too, is with the new robustness of the electronic poll tabs and charitable gambling in general, it's gone from a $1 billion industry to a $2 billion industry over this time frame. We are projecting that this fund will grow, the stadium reserve fund will grow to $191 million by 2023 after removing the supplemental $20 million a year in money from the general fund. So we don't know what that right number is. We actually recommend that we now that we don't need to take the extra $20 million out of the general fund to supplement. We just leave the estimate in there. We let this fund grow because in 2023, for the first time, we can repay or defease some of the bonds. That's the first opportunity legally we have. And if we do that in 2023, if this fund continues to grow at the current rate, we have $190-some million in that account, we can defease about half of the bonds and save upwards of around $200 to $300 million in that process. So anyway, to a long answer to a really nice short question is I don't know.
Mr. Chair,
Albright.
Commissioner, the bonds, the appropriation bonds that were secured to finance the stadium, they are first callable in 23 without
Chair.
Penalty.
Correct.
So is the stadium reserve fund considered an escrow upon prepayment or full payment of those bonds? And is that the totality? If you could give us some kind of a, you know, shot in terms of what that payment in 2023 looks like, if we paid off all the bonds.
Representative France.
Representative?
Commissioner
Thank
France.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, actually, you get paid more than we do, so I think that'd be a demotion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, well, one of the things that right now, you're right, in 2023, I think it's July 1 or June 1 of 2023, is the first time we can legally start defeasing the bonds without any prepayment penalty. So one of the things that we would do, and I don't have those numbers in front of me in terms of the different payoff amounts and what that would save. I can get that for you, so we'll have that in front of the committee. But I think one of the things we're trying to make sure that we do is that because we don't have a specific target in terms of what that repayment ought to be, we do believe that the maintaining that amount in that reserve fund would provide the best opportunity to make early payment on some of that debt. But one of the things that we have to obviously look at is, I mean, certainly we could pay them all off in 2023 if the legislature and the governor wanted to take a look at had the resources. We could simply repay or defease all those bonds at that time and save a lot of money. So, I mean, those bonds are set for, I think, are there 20 years or 2040, some of these bonds go 20 to 30. I forget the actual length of the bond. So we have a lot of time to make that decision about what we want to do at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure to which to test fires, but, you know, as I look at this and I look at the end of session relative to the November forecast, and having followed the narratives and discussions relative to the economy, and I know there was a lot of discussion when the February forecast came out relative to the end of session surplus or deficit, which turned out to be in that $250 million range or whatever. But there's nearly a half a billion dollars change between what was forecast and what the legislature then had to work with. And the reason I'm asking this is there was quite a bit of discussion, and there was interest in the tax bill with giving some tax relief, and yet that had to be based on the forecast that was existing at the time relative to actually what turned about to be a much more positive forecast, even though the narrative had probably deteriorated because of some of the things in the economy. So the question is I realize they're forecast, and I've been around long enough to know that forecasts never come true. But is there any way to adjust or give for legislators to have any input relative to what's come out when there seems to be such a discrepancy between what was believed to be probably a bigger forecast surplus, which indeed did happen, and the one that we had to work with?
Commissioner or whoever.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I appreciate the maybe I'm missensing this, but a sense of frustration that here's the number we have to work with, and then the number gets revised. And if I'd known what that revised number was, I might have made different decisions prior. I think that's the story. I can't forecast the forecast, so I don't know what is going to happen. But we do provide for you our range based on our history of our own forecast accuracy, so that at each forecast you can see, if this forecast is as accurate as our average forecast at that point. Each one is a little, is it a different point from the close of the biennium, then it might be as big as this, the revenues might be as big as this or as low as this. And so you can see, what that range looks like. The fact is they're very big ranges because there is a lot of uncertainty and risk in forecasting. So what I can say is that the accuracy of the forecasts that we produce is a little bit better than the accuracy that the Congressional Budget Office produces for federal forecasts. And so we are not outliers in terms of how much change there is between, from a forecast to the end of the biennium. And so I can't take that risk away or that uncertainty away from you. It's just something that you need to manage.
Representative Vogel. Commissioner, anything less to wind up your presentation?
No, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. And I think this last question reminds me of a quote I saw recently in the paper that predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Yes. Agreed.
Okay, Representative France, you're going to talk a little bit about the effects of the future. Of the shutdown, I guess, and
yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to give you some comments and some concerns we have about the current shutdown. We are now in the 25th day of a partial government shutdown, and generally about three-quarters of the federal government, the federal budget has been passed, so we're dealing with a limited partial shutdown, although if you're experiencing it personally, it doesn't feel like a partial government shutdown, I'm sure. But one of the things that we are concerned about is the effect on state government. Many of you may know that it's not unusual for federal programs to be administered through state agencies, and that state agencies have state employees, some of which are funded by state programs. So we typically get money from the federal government after the fact or as a reimbursement model. So it's not unusual for us as a state to engage in federal activities that are federally funded with state employees who are federally funded. But we do expect and we do get reimbursement within a particular amount of time. Right now, though, we're seeing that delayed. And so what's happening is the risk of the state of Minnesota funding these federal programs is growing on a daily basis because we don't know if we're going to get reimbursed or we don't know when. So there is a concern about the fact we have no guarantee of reimbursement. So if the 3,000 employees who are funded partially or completely by federal funds, if we wanted to lay those people off, which we're not suggesting we should at this time, we would need to give 20 to 30 days notice under our bargaining agreements to send out a layoff notice to those employees. So what I've been trying to do is to provide Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan with some ideas about what kind of risk are we managing on a day-to-day basis, what kinds of decisions should we be making, and at 10 o'clock he's going to be providing some statements about a plan to try to manage and monitor the effect in Minnesota. One of the other things, though, that I wanted to mention was a little bit about how this is affecting the state of Minnesota. Let me get my notes here. One of the concerns that Dr. Klumkidis has talked a little bit about the economic activity. The more uncertainty that we have in the economic activity, economic business models, the less certain people are to engage in economic activity. And so a short shutdown of a day or two or a week, really it's just a delay in reimbursement that's not a significant economic event. However, when you get to like 25 days and more, it looks like, then you start worrying that there actually is being economic activity is being delayed or postponed. Because one of the things that the U.S. Department of Commerce and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are both shut down, and so they produce a lot of information to farmers, to bankers, to investment people, because they report on economic activity, they report on planting activity, crop activity, and that information is now not, the current information is now not available. So that is one of our concerns, is that will make investors a little bit skittish or they won't have the up-to-date information they would like. So that's a concern. The other thing, obviously, is there are a number of people who are engaging in activities that are simply being delayed because they can't access certain federal programs. And so even if we turn the government back on tomorrow, there's going to be a delay in some of these activities because some of these home closings or farm loans will just have to be, they're stacking up now. It's going to take a while to clear that background. One of the things that concerns me as much as anything is the start of the federal tax filing season. The IRS has announced that January 28th is the opening day of their filing season. As many of you know, the Department of Revenue cannot begin its filing season until after the IRS opens, so they anticipate opening on or about the same day. But they only have about 10,000 people working at the IRS when they have over 100,000 workers. I forget what the actual number is. So because they were not funded because the Department of Treasury was not funded. But they do have people working, and they're now actually engaged in doing refund activity. But from my stint as a former revenue commissioner, I know what the start of a filing season is like in terms of getting ready, having the office people working around the clock to get things done, to get things ready. So I'm concerned that date might slip. And as many of us all know, this is going to be more difficult than usual tax filing season. So the last thing we want to do is take any days away from people. But the other side of that, too, is it's really virtually impossible to get on the phone and call the IRS and get any technical assistance. You're just not going to get through to anybody. That's been a problem before now, and it's just exacerbated by this current situation. Many people actually call the Department of Revenue and ask questions about their federal return because they can get through to the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Anyway, that's a concern of mine. You know, another issue is the Supplemental Nutrition Program, SNAP. We have just found out from the USDA, I think it was last week, that those funds will be available through February. But in order to get the February funds available, the states have to get the EBT cards loaded today and tomorrow. What is today? The fifth? What is today?
15th.
I think it's tomorrow. So they're working to accelerate this, and part of the problem is they're working with an agency that's shut down, and they're working with counties and tribes, and the tribal governments have received a lot less money. So we're working in a situation where not everyone is around, but we have to get those that information submitted by tomorrow in order to get the EBT cards loaded later this week for the month of February. So that's a problem. That if that can all get done, then we at least have some assurance that the SNAP payments will be made through February. But then the question becomes, what about after that? So we're in a territory now, uncharted territory. I mean, I've obviously never been here before. None of us have ever been here before. We do a lot of work at MMB to try to analyze where are the federal grants, where are the federal programs, what's being paid on time, what's being delayed. And so what we're trying to give to the governor, lieutenant governor, and to you all when we get done is a sort of a list of how is our risk factor going on a daily basis or a weekly basis in terms of delay and reimbursement. So those are the kinds of things that we're working on. At MMB, there are a lot of you all probably have different stories of individual situations of people experiencing a downtime and not being available. But I just want you to know that we're working on trying to analyze and be ready to make recommendations to the governor about what do we as a state do, because we're facing this dilemma about how much does a state step forward and provide funds or services that are not currently being funded by the federal government, which have in the past been funded by the federal government, and we have no guarantee that we're going to get reimbursed. So with that cheery news, I'll open it up for questions. But I am concerned. I just want, and so I welcome any suggestions or comments or issues that you all have. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I see no questions here. Let's move on to our two fiscal, our House staff people here are going to give us a brief overview about what we oversee and our committee process. And while they're going on, a few people came in after we introductions. Representative Elkins, if you want to explain where you're from, and Representative Long, and then our researcher on the end here, introduce yourself also.
Yeah. Steve Elkins, 49B. I'm succeeding.
Since 1987, when the chair was Tom Rukavina. I also staff the Veterans Division and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Board of Legacy.
Proceed.
And Mr. Chair, because we have limited time, I think what we're going to do is highlight a couple of documents that are in your packet, and then we'll offer that if any of you would like to discuss them in more detail, both Helen and I can meet with you either individually, or if there's interest, we can get a meeting room and meet as a group to discuss the information that we have. The first thing I'm going to highlight is this memo. It's in your packet. It's got the House Research logo on it. And what this is a list of the agencies that are within the State Government Finance Division's jurisdiction. So the way that the budgeting process will work and what you can expect to see over the next few months is that you're going to start out the session with several weeks' worth of agency overview discussions. So you have representatives from each agency within your jurisdiction come and introduce themselves and explain to you what they do and their mission and budgeting needs. And then towards late March, early April, you're going to get what's called a budget target. And the expectation of this committee then is to use that budget target to set operating budgets for all of the agencies within your jurisdiction and recommend a budget to the full House for consideration. And Ms. Roberts can talk a little bit more about how that the fiscal process works. My role in the process that is to help you with legislative drafting. So I draft bills that will come before this committee, also amendments. And so feel free to let me know if you have questions or need something drafted or have a question about policy in front of the committee. In this packet, that depending on kind of how you count, there are somewhere between 27 and like 32 agencies that are within the jurisdiction of this division. It's a little bit unique for all of you. So many other committees only have one or two kind of large, complicated agencies. You have the either benefit or curse of having many agencies. A few of them are very large and complicated. Many of them are smaller and have more limited missions. So I'd encourage you to read through the document. You have the legislative branch's budget will come before this division. All the state constitutional officers will come before this division. The big agencies include MMB, you already heard from the commissioner and the state budget director this morning. The Department of Administration is a large agency that you'll hear about that does state contracting and manages state buildings and leases. Then you have several other smaller agencies that do other sort of back office functions on behalf of all of state government, and some of them that also have more public-facing roles. So you'll hear about those as you get as you go through the committee's overview work, and we're happy to answer questions about those.
Mr. Chair, members, you also have in your packet some pie charts and some fiscal information. I'm not going to go into the detail on it. But just to note, the first pie chart is the general fund budget and what we refer to as the base for this committee. That means the fiscal year 19 appropriation for these agencies rolled over into 2021, and that's how we established the base for the committee. There are a few changes. We have a few forecast items, but for this committee, it's largely that's how the base is established, and you can see that that is $885 million. Again, that's the general fund, and that's where the committee is going to spend most of its time because we're responding to the targets set by Ways and Means. Following that, there's a pie chart that shows the all funds picture for this division, and you can see the it shows a different picture of where some of the major spending happens. And I put the forecast detail for each of the agencies so you can see the various funds. And I think just the story here is to know that for some of our agencies, particularly like Minute and Department of Administration, there is significant non-general fund activity that they are involved with and that might be something that you want to spend some time learning about. I've got on page 10 then some examples of some of these agency billings and internal service funds. You'll see I picked, not to pick on admin, but I picked out admin to show you all of the different activities they have that are not on the general fund but in their internal service funds. Following that, on page 11, there's some additional sources of information on state budgets, and then I've also attached the section of our glossary of fiscal terms that relates to this division. And again, I would emphasize that we're available to meet and explain this further.
And Mr. Chair, I just have one more thing that I do feel obligated to note to all of you. So in my office, in addition to our committee work, we also serve as counsel for the House as an institution. And one important thing that you should all be aware of, because the budget is going to be within your jurisdiction, is the new Legislative Salary Council will be meeting this winter and will recommend new salaries for legislators in March. One of the important aspects of the council, the law that governs that council, is that it prohibits legislators from communicating with the members of the commission while they're deliberating on their work. So one thing I would suggest all of you, because you might get questions as members of this division from your colleagues, is just to make sure that you individually and your colleagues make sure that they don't try to send emails or try to communicate with the members of that council while they're meeting, because that is a violation of the constitutional amendment.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I'm just wondering if there should be some type of a memo or some type of a declaration informing people of the proper distancing, if you will, or the arm's length relationship that commission has with this committee and others. Is that something that the chair should put out, or is from the speaker, or where that should originate? I'm curious, because I think that's a really important function that we don't want to trip over accidentally or otherwise.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yeah, that's a good suggestion. I can take it back to the folks in our office. We'll figure out the right venue to let that message out.
Thank you, Mr. Guerin.
Thank you. And thank you, members. And you might want to take and put the memorandum and these two things that have been talked about in your save folder for future reference to look back at if you have questions.
Mr. Chair, just a point of parliamentary inquiry, if you will. I know that in the temporary rules there was a change in terms of the protocol for transfer and re-referral of bills, not back to the House floor for engrossment, but going back now to the Ways and Means. I'm just wondering, from your perspective as chair of the House State Government Finance Committee, is it intention of this committee to take votes on the bills that come before us, or is it your intention to lay them over for inclusion in your bill, or to be utilized as a re-referral or pullback by the via the memo mechanism by the chair of Ways and Means? Just so the members from my side of the committee structure are aware in terms of what to anticipate.
Representative Albright, I believe it's, and members, I believe it's going to be a combination of both, and as in the past, there'll be some bills that are that'll affect the budget and will affect our budget target that we'll probably maintain in the committee as for possible inclusion. There may be other ones that can go on their own that are individual spending bills that don't affect our general fund budget, and so they may go forward. But it's like it's done in the past. It's just a little different way of calling it, but they'll come down to us from the Ways and Means Committee, and then they go back up the same way they came down. And that's no different than anything that has happened in the past. I think in the past 4 years, it's been any spending bills had to go to Ways and Means anyway, so we passed them to Ways and Means. Other bills had to go to rules to be put on the general, on the calendar and all, and also going forward. So I think it's going to be a combination of both and not that much dissimilar from what has happened in the past.
So, Mr. Chair, I would take from those comments that the protocol for bills affirming their consent coming out of this committee would necessitate a vote then by the committee's members.
If we refer them to Ways and Means, it'll be a vote taken on them. Yes, and the big bill, there'll be a vote taken on that, the omnibus bill that for our budget target will be a vote on, and there'll be votes on other bills. But if it's like I said, it'll be a combination of both. There are individual bills that don't affect the general fund. They'll be voted on and moved up and voted not to pass, which is sometimes in the past, members, they used to pass them, but there's been a change in that, and we vote to refer them to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is it doesn't matter what this committee does, that the chair of Ways and Means can just move a bill whether we do action upon that or not. Is that a correct interpretation of this current structure?
Representative Quam, I do not believe that is so. If they're, just like in the past, if they want to recall a bill out of here, they'll have to do that. But if it's part of our budget, we'll be passing, moving our budget to go to Ways and Means out of this committee up by a vote.
Mr. Chair, can you verify with the Ways and Means Chair, because statements on the House floor seem to indicate that the Ways and Means Chair had the capability to take a bill and move it without action by the committee. We normally used to do that on the House floor. We could have a motion to re-refer and the body would take that. But my understanding is the rule change and the temporary rules allowed the Ways and Means Chair to have that power of the body to take a bill and move it however he wished to. If you could just confirm that and pass it back on to the members of the committee.
I will do that. Any other questions? If not, members, we're adjourned.